to On the Brink Radio, broadcast number 222. This is Jeff Phillips Weverson recording the show live from atop Memory Island here on beautiful Aotea, Great Barrier Island, New Zealand. It's the afternoon of the 3rd of November, Friday, 2017. This show was originally going to be a for fun interview with Memory Island herself, this large sort of rock here on Arafaro Beach, where I've come many times over the past 11 years to play my flute and have my beautiful sunrise and sunset ceremony and commune with the spirits of Aotea and to look out over the ocean towards the east and contemplate the beauties of my Ohana Moana. But today, some things just came on my radar today that really have prompted me to record this show truly in the spirit of On the Brink. And I'm going to talk about geophysical warfare. Most people have no idea what this is, even though it's a topic I've talked about many times on this show. Geophysical warfare, it's nothing new. But what is new is the extent to which it's being deployed around the world and its invisibility to the average person. And this is by design. It's by design. But the subtitle of the show is Geophysical Warfare. What Santa Rosa, Puerto Rico, Florida, Christchurch, Kaikoura, Farewell Spit, and Hawaii all have in common. These are just a few of so-called natural disaster areas or events in recent months and years that all bear many of the salient characteristic signatures of geophysical warfare. And I'll outline what some of those are. Another thing that's inspired this show today is that in about 2 or 3 days, it's going to be the full moon of November. And on the full moon of November last year, 2016, there began a week-long naval exercise in Auckland Harbor called Operation Mahitan Guerrilla. And this was the first time in over 30 years that a U.S. warship had been allowed or invited to into New Zealand waters. And I started talking about this in August of last year, warning people about what this meant. And I didn't go so far as to predict any specific events that might happen, although it did cross my mind. But I focused on, for example, the USS Sampson, which was the big destroyer that was coming. And the big argument focused on, oh, is it nuclear powered or not? And but that's, you know, that's trivial compared to its weaponry. And even if the Navy said that it is not nuclear powered and that it doesn't have nuclear weapons, I guarantee you that the second half of that is a total lie, because for several reasons, it may not have fully blown, MIRVed, surface-to-air, surface-to-surface missiles, but it's surely going to have smaller, what you call micro-nuke warheads on the Tomahawk missiles or Harpoon missiles that it had, and as well as depleted uranium munitions, which could be any form of artillery, bullets, artillery shells, the explosives or ballast in torpedoes, in the ship itself. And we all know that depleted uranium, that's an Orwellian oxymoron. And I've just uploaded to my own YouTube channel a brilliant film I consider to be the best documentary source of information on depleted uranium. It's called The Dr. D.U. and Dying Children. It came out in around the year 2000, I think. But it's brilliant, a very brilliant film. And I've actually communicated with Dr. Ted Wyman, who was featured in that film. the ostensibly stated purpose of Operation Mahitan Guerrilla, with warships from over 30 different countries, was to investigate or practice how to deal with what they call non-conventional security threats. Now, I can tell you what they mean by that. It would be anything that doesn't involve guns or box cutters or just simply blowing things up in the manner of traditional warfare. A non-conventional security threat would include, well, for example, all the different things that geophysical warfare makes possible. They're not going to say that. They have to couch it in sort of Orwellian bureaucraties. Well, I made a big deal talking with the quote-unquote peace activists of Auckland and New Zealand, including who used to be my friend Tim Lynch, the guy that does Green Planet FM radio, who interviewed me a couple of years ago. But he specifically wouldn't talk about any of this stuff, and he still won't. He's terrified of even touching it with a 10-foot selfie stick. Anyway, after I'd made a really, really big deal about just the presence of all these warships in the same place at the same time, I didn't even say that something big was bound to happen, but that just the concentrated presence of all these warships represented a major threat to marine life itself, based on the information that I've covered in depth in the past year, with many thanks to my friends Dr. Terry Lilly of Kauai, Hawaii, and Stuart Simonson of Roswell, Georgia, who we've done several interviews and dialogues about the effects of the naval revolution in military affairs that has a lot to do with the use of electromagnetic fields and microwaves. And Stuart Simonson focuses on the electrification of the marine environment from the cathodic protection system of boats that electrifies the marine environment, but also how the same technology has been weaponized by the navies, as they do. What they do to weaponize something, and this could apply to Mother Nature as well as a technology, to weaponize something, one of the simplest ways to do it is to just sort of make it a lot more powerful. Like if you've got a cathodic protection system that generates electric currents. I'm being interrupted by the sound of an airplane from either Great Barrier Airlines or Fly My Sky. It's one of the planes that sounds like a chainsaw flying. The reason is that they take the mufflers off these planes to get more power, just like a Hoon would take the muffler off his car or his motorcycle. It makes it about 10 times louder, which is the part that I notice here. I'm not worried about how many people can fly to and from this island. In fact, it would suit me perfectly well if plane flights were banned here, except for maybe emergency purposes. Let people take the boat. It's a 4 or 5 hour trip. It's much more romantic and much more fitting to the beauty and power of this place. But Terry Lilly and Stuart Simonson and I have covered in depth the whole electrification of the marine environment scenarios over the past few months and with our various interviews. But it was extraordinarily interesting that on the very morning that Operation Mahitan Guerrilla began, which I believe was the 16th of November, anyway, I'm not sure of the exact date, but I'm pretty sure that exact date was the day of the full moon. On that exact morning, it was a Monday, On that day or that morning, there was a giant 7.8 earthquake that totally devastated the coastal town of Kaikoura on the South Island of New Zealand. And over the next few days, I talked with a lot of people, and there was eyewitness accounts of seeing both naval vessels, possibly U.S. and New Zealand and other countries, naval vessels in and around Kaikoura both before, during, and after this major earthquake, as well as seismic testing boats. And after I started looking into it, the parallels between this and the massive Christchurch earthquake of 2011, I was really blown away by the very, very, very parallel and similar set of circumstances surrounding these whole things, both of which had massive presences of official, bureaucratic, military, and corporate interests meeting and gathering there. In Christchurch, it was the U.S.-New Zealand Global Partnership Forum, and in Auckland, it was the Operation Mahi Tangaroa war game celebrating the 75th anniversary of New Zealand's Navy, but also hosting a giant conference sponsored by Lockheed that had over 500 weapons manufacturers, with a convention in Auckland that began that day too. So most people are just going to go, hey, but this is just a coincidence. Yeah, but when the coincidences start lining up time after time, and all the other salient signature characteristics are there, which I've gone to great trouble to document in my writing and blogs and radio shows, and so many people, especially the people here in New Zealand, which I can really, I think the word sheeple is probably too kind to describe the mentality. It's like they've, you know, I don't think the story of an ostrich putting their head in the sand is necessarily really true. I've never witnessed it. It's probably just one of those superstitions or old wives' tales. But the people in New Zealand definitely do put their head in the sand. And, you know, they're gradually making progress to come out of the island mentality, cognitive backwaters of this place. And I love New Zealand, the land, the birds and the trees and the honeybees and the plants and everybody, but it's the people, the sheeple, that I have a hard time with here, just like everywhere, really. But another thing today, there was a big article posted, and I'd really like to thank my beautiful friends at Stranded No More for their ongoing brilliant contributions to understanding and comprehending the real global threats to whales and dolphins. An article published by a writer named Jamie Morton that writes for the New Zealand Herald. And this article was looking at a recently published scientific article by people in Oregon and Cornell University about the adverse effects of seismic testing on whales. As if this was something new that we're just now discovering. This is like decades old information. And just because there aren't very many fully peer-reviewed scientific articles or research done on this kind of thing, doesn't mean that we don't know how dangerous it is. I mean, it's pure logic. The whales and dolphins are all highly sophisticated beings whose primary sensory channel of perception and communication is sound. We all know from basic physics that sound travels much more quickly and powerfully in water than it does in air, because water is a denser medium. We all know how loud the seismic testing blasts are. So put 1 and 2 and 3 together, and what do you have? Seismic testing is automatically going to be dangerous for whales and dolphins. And the technicalities arise, and you go like, oh, well, aren't there safe levels of it? You know, all the possible marginalization techniques that could ever be brought in by public relations and the, for example, the Navy public relations apparatus, who try to say that nothing they do hurts anything. But finally, this article came out, and I mean, I'll tell you, I've been trying to get the seismic testing thing on the agenda of all the whale and dolphin people here in New Zealand for like 15 years, and people like, I'll name some names, Liz Sluton down at the University of Otago, she scoffed at me quite a few years ago when I dared bring up the whole thing about seismic testing as if that couldn't possibly be any kind of real threat to worry about. But just in the past couple of months, I've seen her review an article about it, and now I think she's has something to do with the popularization of this article. Other people like K. Karen Stockin of Massey University on the North Island. She scoffed at me a couple of years ago when I was talking about seismic testing and stuff too. And so now these people are finally almost waking up to it a little bit, which is good. But it's not, because A, it's not going to make any difference. Do you think that just because another scientific article is talking about the danger of seismic testing to whales and dolphins, that it's going to make any difference? All it's going to do is give the public relations people that work for big oil something to do. They're going to go, oh, well, for sure, we're going to look into this. We're going to mitigate our seismic testing and make it safe for whales and dolphins. And it's just going to be more of the same, pardon me, fucking bullshit that we've heard over and over and over again. And the Maui's dolphins, who are right in the middle of all this, the true symbol of how 100% clean and green New Zealand really is. Beautiful little Maui's dolphins teetering on the very brink of extinction, right in the middle of the biggest fishing trawling areas in New Zealand and the biggest area of hydrocarbon exploration and extraction, the Taranaki Basin. So, the whole geophysical warfare paradigm is so pervasive, yet so invisible, that it's totally supplanted and superseded the threats from seismic testing, for example, and even low-frequency active sonar. These are all, low-frequency active sonar and seismic testing are very similar because they use similar giant transducers that are often in towed arrays behind a boat that emit these really powerful blasts of sound like underwater shockwaves that can travel for hundreds if not thousands of kilometers and create adverse acoustic effects for hundreds of thousands of cubic kilometers. And the statistics and exact measurements and sound levels and all this stuff is really immaterial, because even if what the scientists don't even consider is that if you put yourself in their place, we have, for people that aren't deaf, you know how easily you've been annoyed by sounds that really aren't that loud, but they're still really annoying because maybe of when they're happening or the quality of the sound, something about its rhythm or its timbre, its tonal characteristics, and when it's happening. All of these can be equally or more annoying than just how loud it is. Same with the whales and dolphins. You know, unless they have some magic ability to just turn off their hearing, which I don't think they would do, even if they could, because it would be like you closing your eyes while you're walking down the street. Who could do that and still feel safe and without bumping into something? So that means that they're constantly going to be being bombarded by every possible sound and noise that human military industrial civilization makes. And this is a true global threat that I've talked about before in my recent show about homomimic, holistic modeling marine impacts of military industrial civilization. Well, geophysical warfare involves not acoustic technologies, but electromagnetic technologies based on the work of Nikola Tesla and the whole HARP thing that you might have heard of, High Altitude Rural Research Project, which is actually an Orwellian misnomer for, to make it sound like it was just a research instrument. It's actually one of the most sophisticated geophysical weapon systems ever invented, but it was actually just a prototype. This thing is old school now. It's been superseded by probably hundreds, if not thousands, of similar, smaller, transportable devices that can be on the sea, on floating platforms, mounted on every naval vessel, on platforms that can be moved around on trucks, in airplanes, and in satellites. And now, with a new revolution in undersea warfare, you've got HARP-type stuff that can operate underwater. This is the kind of stuff that's not even on people's radar. This is the real state-of-the-art in geophysical warfare, that when you start talking about it, people just literally, especially here in New Zealand, they just stick their head in a bucket of sand. Or A, after calling it a bunch of conspiracy theory, then they put their head in the sand. I've seen and experienced this many, many times. And I've talked about this many times. The geophysical warfare, it's one of the Mac Daddies of its whole strategic deployment was Zbigniew Brzezinski, who just passed away last year. And his mentor, Gordon J. F. McDonald, that wrote this amazing article called How to Wreck the Environment in 1968. But that article is like a blueprint for what we're seeing with the world of geophysical warfare now. So one of the main things that they do with these technologies, which are, in general, you could call them ionospheric heaters. They're microwave transmitters that heat up certain parts of the ionosphere. And they can do many, many things. But one of the main things they do is they, by using specific frequencies and wavelengths of energy, they can create a lens or a mirror that exists temporarily in a part of the ionosphere and then shift frequencies and wavelengths and then beam down or reflect or refract another beams of microwaves that can send it down somewhere else. And they can have many of these happening at the same time. So it's like the whole sky could be crisscrossed with all these beams of microwaves bouncing off of satellites and ionospheric lenses and mirrors going down to the Earth's crust and to other transmitters, to submarines, to boats, to dishes on the land. And all this is being operated and orchestrated by really complex banks of computers with the best simulations of natural processes that exist. And they've got arrays of sensors all over every dimension of the planet. This is a constant simulation, computer-operated, orchestrated geophysical warfare operation that's going on. And I don't even think people have anything to do with it anymore, except maybe tweak the algorithms here and there. One of the things that they're doing is what you'd call the weaponization of natural disasters. It, on the surface, if you just look from a distance and I have a casual impression of something had happened, you go, oh, yeah, there was just some really severe fires in Santa Rosa, California. Or there was a really weird hurricane with an erratic course that got Florida and Puerto Rico. Or there was really anomalous earthquakes that struck Christchurch, New Zealand, even though Christchurch was believed to be one of the most seismically stable parts of New Zealand, in Kaikoura, on the exact same day that the giant military exercise was happening in Auckland. And the anomalous strandings of all the whales at Farewell Spit there on the South Island, just right when the Kaikoura quake happened. And then all the whales, the pilot whales that beached themselves in Hawaii, right when there was all this naval military activity happening there, all these coincidences. Well, really, in the world of today, and I'm kidding when I say this, but I'm not, many, many people would go, ah, well, you know, there's only one thing big and bad and evil enough in the world that could do all this, and it's climate change. Because look at all the bogey warnings that Al Gore gave us in An Inconvenient Truth. He said climate change could cause all this stuff. And so part of what geophysical warfare does is the exacerbation of natural disasters. They're not going to necessarily, yet anyway, they're not going to create some kind of disaster that's never happened before. It would draw too much attention to itself. But they'll create stuff that people are used to hearing about. Fires, earthquakes, hurricanes and cyclones, whale strandings, things like that. But they just intensify them. They make them worse. And that's mainly a product of just adding thermal microwave energy into whatever system is involved. That's easy to do. That's what HAARP geophysical warfare technologies are really, really good at. But back to the climate change thing, I've just seen so much bullshit. It's made my eyes turn brown at times from just reading about all the climate change stuff and how every possible thing in the world can be attributed to that now. And you see it every day. Well, I'd like to thank Mike Adams, the health ranger of naturalnews.com, for his brilliant series of articles lately talking about climate change and how carbon dioxide not only is not a toxin, it's like the oxygen of the plant kingdom. Without carbon dioxide, we wouldn't have any plants and no larger life forms would exist. That's pure science, pure common sense, pure knowledge. Which really surprises me that anybody that's with even half of a neuron functioning can think that there could be anything bad about carbon dioxide or carbon. And I'd also like to thank a guy named Peter Kirby, who's a writer for Activist Puzz. He published a series of articles a few months ago referring to chemtrails and the HAARP. He didn't really use the expression geophysical warfare, but that's really what he's describing. Geophysical warfare scenario as the new Manhattan Project. And I think that's a very good analogy. A very good analogy. And he's the only person other than myself, really, that I've seen talk about the psychological operation or psychological warfare dimension of geophysical warfare. But that's what the whole climate change scenario actually is. Climate change, which used to be global warming, is a meme foisted by the powers that be, launched in direct parallel to go along with the whole advent of geophysical warfare. Climate change scenario is a smokescreen that gives bogus scientific reasoning based on the greenhouse effect and carbon dioxide. It's the main idea of climate change is that a few parts per million of carbon dioxide higher is going to create extreme weather, all of which is bad. No extreme weather that's good. Extreme weather that's bad. And it's going to create really, really severe fires. It's going to create really, really powerful hurricanes. It's going to create floods and cities on the coast to fall in the ocean. It's going to create anomalous earthquakes and just the relocation of people and famine and plagues of locusts and just every possible thing. But if you look at Al Gore's film, An Inconvenient Truth, and look at the list of things that he says that climate change is going to cause, that list matches up precisely with the list of stuff that they said HAARP can do. If you look at the work of Dr. Nick Begich, who really single-handedly exposed HAARP from its inception due to his insider connections. We owe Dr. Nick Begich a lot for our understanding of geophysical warfare. But I really think that geophysical warfare could be described as the new Manhattan Project because Dr. Nick Begich himself, in his book Angels Don't Play This HAARP and in their film Holes in Heaven, says that the threshold into geophysical weaponry based on microwaves is as big of a step as it was from gunpowder, from sticks and stones and arrows and knives to gunpowder, and then from gunpowder to atomic weapons. The leap from atomic weapons and gunpowder to geophysical warfare using electromagnetic fields and microwaves is that big of a transition. And you can really understand why if you ever take the time to look into it. I'd also like to thank my brilliant researcher friend Richard K. Moore of Ireland, who I've interviewed a couple of times. He has some of the best observations and analyses of the reality of real climate change, because climate change is as real as a climate. Climate change is, if you have a climate, you're going to have climate change. Only it doesn't happen overnight. It doesn't happen in weeks, months, or even years or decades. Climate change happens over periods of thousands of years. It's a slow process. Other than that, we're talking about weather. But Richard K. Moore has some great articles about the reality of climate change, a lot of which are based on the electric universe hypothesis, which makes a lot of sense. And Rachel Carson, one of my biggest heroes of all time, she had some brilliant things to say about climate change, and specifically referring to the work of a Swedish guy named Otto Pettersson, who was researching deep ocean currents as being major drivers of long-term climate change. So this is the kind of stuff to look into, not the greenhouse effect, but I jokingly had been hearing about this guy named Elon Musk, and I was fed up with the climate change thing and also the whole thing with going into space. So I wrote a satire about Elon Musk buying the entire U.S. military for $700 trillion and then using it to wage war on climate change. And this article got a lot of attention, and it also got banned. It's been declared unsafe by Facebook. So what does that tell you? I strongly suggest that you read this article because Well, I didn't know anything about Elon Musk at the time I wrote this, but then I started reading some interviews, and to my astonishment, some of the stuff that I just made up, thinking it was too far-fetched to be true, turned out to be real. Like, for example, that he wants to go and live on Mars, and he wants to use nuclear devices to terraform Mars. Now, what kind of mentality would even think of doing something like that? That's like Edward Teller. You know, it seems like Elon Musk is kind of like a cross between... Remember Howard Hughes, the really eccentric millionaire that had fingernails that were like 6 inches long, and he had Hughes Aircraft that did a lot of defense contracting for the military? Very, very eccentric millionaire, billionaire kind of guy. I think that the character in Jodie Foster's movie Contact that lived in space, I think he was modeled after Howard Hughes. But anyway, Elon Musk is kind of like a cross between Howard Hughes and Wernher von Braun, the Nazi SS officer who got imported through Project Paperclip to found NASA and develop the Saturn rockets. So anyway, Elon Musk, what better man to lead the war using the U.S. military to destroy climate change? I even wrote a little song. Goes to the tune of Glory, Glory, Hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Climate change we're gonna do, ya. We'll knock you in your teeth and kick you on your sorry ass, cause you love carbon dioxide gas. And another thing that relates is my show from 2 weeks ago about computers, or the solid-state entity as a form of extraterrestrial intelligence. Now, that's not really that far-fetched. All of geophysical warfare, as well as everything nuclear, it wouldn't be possible without really advanced computer systems and networks. Computers wouldn't be possible without electricity. So what if we create it? We've got a planet-wide electrical grid. We've got a planet-wide computer network. We've got a planet-wide nuclear scenario, a planet-wide hydrocarbon scenario, a planet-wide military scenario. All of these are growing exponentially. We've got the technogeneous presence of cities and everything industrial. This is all what we call civilization. Where is it all leading? Well, right now we're just literally waging war on every aspect of life. But most of it's invisible to people. You've got to dig and learn and educate yourself scientifically to sort of form any kind of big picture of all this stuff with any degree of resolution whatsoever. The ultimate application of geophysical warfare technologies, according to the visionaries Brzezinski and McDonald, is for a global mind control apparatus. And who knows how many Pentagon black budget projects have been devoted to this. Clearly, it would be extensions of MK Ultra, which I'm sure never stopped. But Brzezinski talks about, and quotes McDonald as talking about using electromagnetic pulses, which wouldn't have to be very powerful, but just properly timed the right frequency and power level to debilitate the mentality of the people in entire hemispheres. And so what does that tell you? I mean, even back then, these are top people. Brzezinski was Obama's top national security advisor. McDonald was LBJ's top science advisor. These are advisors to presidents of the United States talking about this stuff. Even then, it's like the people are the enemy. The people of all countries, not some demonized Middle Eastern country like Syria or Iraq or Iran or Libya or whatever. It's all people, all life. But this is really the truth. This is the enemy of the military. In the same way that Admiral Nuremberg in his chapter, The Militarized Ocean, which is in the same book that Gordon MacDonald's chapter, How to Wreck the Environment, is in. It's called Unless Peace Comes by Nigel Calder. In the same way that Nirenberg says that the way that the Navy looks at marine life as biological interference, and Stuart Simonson says that the military looks at us as biological contaminants. That's how the powers that be look at anything that's alive. And I'd really like to emphasize the important work of Dr. Claudia von Werloff, who's a succeeding Dr. Rosalie Bertell, who was a Catholic nun and medical doctor who was a pioneer in understanding the health effects of ionizing radiation. But then she went on to write a brilliant book called Planet Earth, Latest Weapon of War, that came out in 2000, looking at the weaponization of Mother Earth herself. I was honored to be in communication with her, and she asked permission to reprint a part of one of my articles in something she was writing. This was at the time that she died, in June of 2012. I remember on that very day, Elizabeth and I were here at Arafaro Beach, and one of the most brilliant double rainbows I've ever seen formed that afternoon. It was like the entire sky, all the way down to where we were, was just filled with this golden light. And I think that was the spirit of Rosalie coming to bless us with her beautiful rainbow angel wings. I'll never forget that day. Lizard was just standing on the beach, dumbfounded. But I've brought up my concept of the Atlantean discontinuity. I really think that the geophysical warfare is truly of Atlantean proportion, in the sense that if the story is true that Atlantis was a highly evolved civilization technologically that either destroyed itself or triggered its own destruction through military-industrial processes, experimentation, or accidents that it was engaged in, or, as Plato said, they incurred the wrath of the gods by what they were doing. And so the gods, being perhaps forces of the cosmos, the planets, the devas of the solar system, of the heliocosm, maybe allowed a fragment of common inky to penetrate the Earth's magnetic field, whereas it might have been diverted, or maybe the Atlantean experiments altered the Earth's magnetic field and drew one of these fragments of common inky right down to destroy Atlantis. And we happen to be right at this very time, as I talked about on last week's show, we're still in that early November window of the two times per year when a fragment of common inky, known this time of year as the Taurids, would have a higher probability of colliding with the Earth. And these researchers in the Czech Republic have just published an article revealing that they may have discovered where the largest fragment of common inky might be, sort of hidden behind a cloud of debris. I think the whales and dolphins have a memory of having experienced one or more impacts of comets or asteroids, and their ancestors lived through it, but life on the land was brought to its very knees. We don't have to keep conducting geophysical warfare. At least, unlike the nuclear scenario, in which all these probably thousands of millions of tons of high-level radioactive waste have been produced and are sitting around in various storage facilities and holding tanks and in the reactors and in all the weapons. The reactors are still churning it out and all the contaminated water. All this stuff, you can't just turn it off and it goes away. This stuff is with us from now till kingdom come. The only thing that's going to cleanse that is massive geological or tectonic upheavals of the whole surface of the Earth and churn all this stuff down under the ground to where it's going to just literally bury it really, really, really deeply. But, you know, how many life forms are going to survive that? Yet that could be what's in store for what Mother Earth's going to have to do to cleanse herself of the Homo sapien macrovirus. unlike the nuclear scenario, which is the hardest to get rid of, at least with the geophysical warfare, it's all electrical and operated by computers, so it could all just be switched off, and then you'd be left with all this electronic hardware. HARP can be turned off with a switch, as can the computers, the computer simulations. So at least we do still have a modicum of control over geophysical warfare, unless it has all been handed over to systems of computers to run and operate the whole thing. This was one of the main things I brought up in the show about computers. It's like, you know, artificial intelligence and robotics, teaching computers to supposedly learn and think. These are cognitive processes that I don't think really apply, because really all the computers do is actually crunch numbers. They give the impression of thinking, the impression of reasoning, the impression of decision making, but they're not really thinking or reflecting. They're computing. It's an increasingly knee-deep nightmare that we're creating, and I've been looking out at Mother Ocean the whole time I'm recording this show, looking out to exactly where I saw the beautiful humpback whales just a few days ago, which was an amazing visit, first time I've seen any here. And then the next day, in almost the same location, only further out, was a naval vessel. An interesting juxtaposition of nature and military. Such is the world we live in, but I don't know for how much longer. Anyway, a message to the people of New Zealand. Get your head out of the sand and listen to what I've been telling you for the past 15 years. Seismic testing and low-frequency sonar are very, very dangerous and global threats to whales and dolphins, but they're superseded now by geophysical warfare, and there's no better place in the world to see the signature effects of geophysical warfare than here in New Zealand. The weather, I think, is clearly being manipulated by environmental modification technologies. The anomalous earthquakes, the stranding of all the pilot whales down on Farewell Spit right after the Kaikoura quake, the Christchurch quake, and then the Santa Rosa fires, the ongoing persistent drought in California, which is the 10th largest economy in the world and the breadbasket of America, the flooding and devastation from the hurricane with a really bizarre trajectory that destroyed Florida and Puerto Rico, and the pilot whales that stranded in Hawaii. Terry Lilly has documented so much about these underwater drones that have been deployed by Raytheon and the Navy there. This is like a major proving ground for all these new weapon systems there off of Kauai, Hawaii in general. But anything that's underwater is practically invisible and unknowable to the average person. And one of the big strategies of geophysical warfare, as Gordon MacDonald talks about, that most people aren't going to suspect anything anytime they see a fire, a hurricane, a flood, an earthquake. They're not going to think anything's unusual, no matter how severe it is, because this is things that nature can do. So part of the strategy is that the geophysical warfare acts are hidden within the great irregularities of nature. So with the help of people like myself, who are doing a lot of legwork and research and investigation to draw a picture of this for people to see, I wish people would pay more attention instead of putting their heads down in the sand. Pull your heads out, people! Wake up! This is Jeff Weverson signing off from On the Brink Radio. Hey, wahi tapu, wahi arahi mai, ingya tahora, megnya aihi, megnya kakariki, nya kahola. All the whales and dolphins, I love you. Thank you, Aotea, Memory Island. Mitukaya yasin. Live simply so that others may simply live. Thank you.
Thank you.